Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. February 14th marked the first anniversary of the massive uprising in Bahrain, which has been severely repressed. Tens of thousands of people attempted to march to Pearl Square in the capital, Manama, which was destroyed after protesters occupied it last year. We saw a spike in the coverage on the day of the protests, but it has since died down. Mariam Al-Khawaja of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights told Al Jazeera that the protests had never stopped in Bahrain, but media coverage of the situation in the country had. Today's guest, Mona Karim, reports that since the revolutionary protests started, tens of people have been killed either by bullets, tear gas, suffocation, torture, or by police cars running them over. Many opposition figures, medics, athletes, students, netizens, journalists, and unknown protesters are still in jail or facing trial. Yet oppression has not succeeded in holding the protesters back. Mona Karim is an independent journalist who writes for Global Voices, Jadalia.com, and MigrantRights.com, and she joins us from New York. Hi, Mona. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Sorry, I bumbled that. How many people have been killed? Do we know?
We know that the number has exceeded 40 people.
Okay.
And some of them died of torture, and others were killed or shot or suffocated by gas, as you mentioned.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I just wanted to clarify that. We're also joined today by Greg Kaufman. He's a writer for The Nation, where he has a blog called This Week in Poverty. His latest post focuses on President Obama's budget, which affects the poor. It calls for a 50% cut to the Community Services Block Grant, which is utilized by more than 1,000 community action agencies to help people move toward economic security through job training, employment, reliable housing, and transportation. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. Michael's latest piece focuses on the extension of the payroll tax holiday, which overwhelmingly passed today. It continues the 2% break and extension of emergency unemployment benefits for the rest of the year. The $152 billion measure also prevents a change in Medicare funding formulas that would have slashed payments to doctors by about a third. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So before we begin, I wanted to recognize and mention the death of Anthony Shadid, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was regarded by so many of his peers as one of the great foreign correspondents of his generation. And he died in Syria yesterday after he had a horrible asthma attack. He was only 43 years old. He was reporting for the New York Times. Anthony Shadid grew up in Oklahoma. He's a Lebanese-American. He was fluent in Arabic. And he's being widely remembered. I've been reading a lot of pieces about him, widely remembered for giving the people a voice. Politico called him, quote, a voice of the people for everyday Iraqis. And he was in Baghdad after the U.S. invaded. He stayed there on the ground because he said he wanted people to know what it was like for Iraqis to live in darkness. And I wanted you all to comment on the death of Anthony Shadid. And also, I think it's interesting that so many people in the media are talking about the fact that he did give average people a voice when that is so rare in today's media. Mona, what are your thoughts on this?
I think, honestly, the world of journalism lost a very important guy. To us, like, he played a very important role to bring the voices of Arabs in the Middle East in general, especially to the West. And the fact that he was bilingual, the fact that he died in Syria tells you a lot, because Syria is not the most, you know, tense place. Tens of people are dying every day. So the fact that he dared and went there shows his courage, shows his, what he attempts to reveal through journalism. And that's why many people, I think, are, feeling this loss.
And what would you add to that, Greg Kaufman?
Well, I think it's interesting that so many people are writing today of this important voice for the people, so many publications. because I think it's getting harder and harder as a journalist to be able to tell those kinds of stories. I mean, there's more of an emphasis on lots of posts quickly, and there's smaller bureaus and less funding. And so it kind of reminds me of poverty, where we talk about, the media tends to talk about poverty when the census numbers come out and then ignore it the rest of the year. So I hope that we'll keep talking about the importance of telling the stories of everyday people, and that we'll do that.
And Michael, what really struck me is Terry Gross of Fresh Air interviewed Anthony Shadid in December, and she's replaying that interview today. And just taking the time to listen to him speak for about 40 minutes about his experiences everywhere from Baghdad to the West Bank to Libya and to Syria, it just makes you realize that that's just so rare in our dialogue today. As Greg said, it's so much about the political back and forth and the fighting and these sort of thoughtful comments about what really happens on the ground to allow someone to take 5 minutes to explain it is just very rare these days.
It's extremely rare, and I can't remember if the stories I read in the Times were by him or someone else. They were probably by him, but I have some vivid memories of tales that looked at the lives of actual human beings and it bringing home very clearly what the war meant to the people who actually lived there. And just to pick up on Greg's point, if you cover the presidential campaign or if you read coverage about the presidential campaign, how often do you hear about the lives of the people in the towns where all these reporters are? You don't. You hear about the speech or the attack point or, you know, whatever message they're trying to get out today, and you don't hear about the lives of the people there. It's endemic to our business, unfortunately.
And why is that? He did a lot of reporting for the Washington Post, and his pieces got so much attention. It's clear that people really want this news, even though we're often told that they don't. And then he went on to write for the New York Times. He was nominated for a Pulitzer this year, actually. They say Anthony Shadid, quote, brought a poet's voice, a deep empathy for the ordinary person. Why is this kind of reporting so rare?
A lot of it has to do with resources. A lot of news agencies need to get the most bang for their buck, so they'll put one person or two people on a story where they used to have a whole team, and you need to get the main news of the day, so you don't really have the time to go and dig into people's lives and get their real stories. It's getting rarer and rarer.
And Anthony Shadid actually has a book coming out next month called House of Stone, a memoir of home, family, and a lost Middle East. And during the interview with Terry Gross in December, he said he was very frustrated with remote-controlled journalism. You don't really have any choice but to cover what's happening in a place like Syria from a neighboring country. He did sneak in a few times, but those are the realities on the ground. And Mona, you're facing the same realities in reporting about what's happening in Bahrain. Because journalists can't get in, you have no choice but to follow Twitter and follow Facebook, and your latest post for Global Voices is about social media and what you've gleaned from social media about what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, definitely. The problem is that the regime in Bahrain, and so many regimes as well, tried to harass journalists, tried to tell them that, you know, you are not welcomed, you are viewed as... you know, you're leaking the news, you're embarrassing us, and we cannot fight you through social media or by denying you visa or deporting you. All of these methods that the regime is using against journalists. So we're seeing less and less journalists attempting to go there. And there's what's happening now in Bahrain that can be viewed positively and negatively at the same time is that every citizen is turning to be a journalist.
And that is Mona Karim. She's an independent journalist who's been reporting on what's happening in Bahrain, but she cannot do it from inside the country because she can't get in. And she'll be with us for about 15 more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of Bahrain, we'd love to hear from you. And now would be a good time to call 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So the Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in the year since the uprising began, the government has targeted the press with assault, detention, harassment, and torture to obstruct their coverage. Al Jazeera English has a piece called Suppressing the Narrative in Bahrain, and they report that when they applied for visas, they received a letter stating, quote, due to the high volume of applications, we will not be able to grant your visa for the specified dates. Correspondents from outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, all of their applications have been denied. It kind of reminds me of Iran. Whenever we do stories about Iran, we also talk to people who are outside of the country. How are you getting your information about what's going on inside Bahrain?
Well, it has been argued before that how Arab Spring comes hand in hand with social media, because not only that the regime tried to fight foreign journalism getting inside, they also control completely local media. And when you read local media, it just reminds you of all the like propaganda, and it's obviously very silly and written the way the government wants it to be. So what's happening now is that citizen journalist, this concept is developing very fast, especially in Bahrain. We see a lot of people trying to tweet and post on Facebook in different languages, most importantly English, because they believe that they should target the other world. They should, you know, get the truth to others. So they post pictures, they post videos, they write down names and details and timing. When was this person arrested? Where was he arrested? What happened to him? You know, all these details, all this documentation, later on adopted by human rights organizations, most notably behind the Human Rights Center. They always, like, every day update and put the details, because you are creating the memory of a nation. You have years of mistreatment and discrimination and violence against those who are asking for change. So this is where we get access. Actually, you can notice even that there are some journalists, few journalists who are actually there, yet they also use social media because they cannot use regular journalism to say all the details.
And I'm looking at a map, actually, of the Middle East. Bahrain is a small island state near the western shores of the Persian Gulf. Population is almost 1.3 million, a very small country. What do you think Americans need to know about Bahrain?
I believe Americans need to understand that, yes, it's a small country. Yes, you know, the number of people getting killed every day are not as much as they are in Syria, but we need to realize that if one person is killed, 50 people are killed, it's the same. There is a crime going on, and people are trying to ignore it. People are trying to say, well, this is just temporary, they're going to fix it. What's really dangerous is that some media establishments are practicing this kind of tone, saying, oh, yes, what's happening in Bahrain is bad, so we are calling for reforms. And they do not realize the importance that reforms are already too late. You know, the opposition and the people themselves called for these things for decades now. Like, the struggle of Bahraini people has been going on for over half a century. It was first against colonialism, and then it was against, you know, the dictatorship. And then they thought they had an agreement with the current king a decade ago. But then, again, he did not respect the agreement. And he just, you know, the mistreatment, the torture, the arrest, all of these things kept happening. You know, the discrimination, not getting a job, not getting education, all these, like, basic rights being denied. So he fueled them. Like, the regime fueled those people and pushed them to have an uprising, which they wouldn't want to have otherwise, you know. But they pushed them, and now we see its result. And to talk about reforms is to insult all those who were killed or you know, arrested and so on, because we don't only need reform. There has to be a change in the root, you know. There has to be a change that make people feel, okay, now we can trust you, now we can proceed and make reforms.
And what about, what are you hearing on Twitter? What do the people of Bahrain, what message do they want to get out?
They are trying to say, you know, number one, we don't want you to ignore us. You know, we don't want media dealing with us this way, because the support of other people, other nations, will mean a lot and will bring pressure on the regime. So the regime will have to be, you know, less violent and will have to listen to the others and be you know, cautious. So that's a very important message. Another message is that they have no other choice. You know, if you don't have any local place to put to get information to. You just need the others to have it. You know, they need this, the internet or social media as an outsource. You know, crowdsourcing, let's say, what's happening to them, the violations and so on. Because, you know, if people know, if people realize your struggle, that will make the struggle bigger, that will get more people to the streets, and that will make more pressure.
We're speaking with Mona Karim. She's an independent journalist who writes for Global Voices. She's been covering what's happening on the ground in Bahrain from outside of the country because she cannot get in. This week, the Bahraini government denied visas to several media outlets, including the New York Times and Al Jazeera English. We're also joined by The Nation's Greg Kaufman and the Huffington Post's Michael McAuliffe. And Mona will be with us for about five or so more minutes. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kate Raphael, who's calling in from Oakland. Kate and five other international human rights observers were arrested in Bahrain this week. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. And I actually have to correct that and say that it's now 10 of us.
10, okay.
Who have been arrested and deported. I'm not going to say how many people. I was there with a group called Witness Bahrain. And we were invited specifically because of what you all have been talking about, the exclusion of journalists and human rights workers as well. I know Human Rights Watch was told that none of the applications for their workers to come in would be granted during February, that they would have to wait until March because of the lead up to the anniversary commemorations and protests. The attempt to return to Pearl Roundabout, where the encampment was destroyed last March. So we were invited by human rights activists, local human rights activists, to come and witness and report on what was happening on the ground. And I'm not going to say how many people we have there, but I will say that 10 of us have now been arrested and deported within 5 days, pretty much in six different incidents, like six different operations by the government specifically targeting each of us. So my name was printed in the paper numerous times that the police were looking for me and in order to exclude me. And, you know, they put a number of undercover officers on the 14th. It was very clear when I was arrested that this group of undercovers, their mission for that afternoon was to find and arrest me. They were walking around with my picture. And the same thing was happening with each of the other international observers, witnesses, activists who had been reporting on our website about what we had observed and experienced as part of, you know, while participating in and observing the anniversary protests. And, I mean, two things I want to say about that. One is it's clearly a losing strategy for the government. I mean, the fact that they've excluded journalists means that journalists were relying on us and on the local activists. But, I mean, we were being called daily, almost hourly, by Al Jazeera and CNN and even MSNBC. You know, people were asking for our footage that local activists are shooting on their iPhones and posting on Twitter because they don't have, you know, they're not in the country to do what they call the objective reporting. So, I mean, it's a little hard to find it. But if you look on the New York Times blog, you'll find an incredible article that I just ran across yesterday that I would say two-thirds of which comes straight from our website, which is witnessbahrain.org.
So, Kate, so you actually once, because you got a lot of attention also about the arrest, so once this happened, you were actually contacted by the U.S. media to get your footage and the information that you gleaned in Bahrain?
Yeah, honestly, even before the arrest, we were being contacted because, you know, we sent things out. As soon as we were established, I mean, we knew that it would be very difficult to get in, and in fact, four of our people were denied entry. So we were very quiet about our intention. You know, we didn't announce to anyone that we were going to be coming in. But once we had critical mass in the country, we sent out a press release announcing our presence and our website. And almost immediately, we started getting contacted by U.S. media, and as well, I would say first international media, U.K., because of the colonial relationship between Britain and Bahrain, there's a lot of interest in Bahrain from U.K., so we had a lot of contacts initially from UK journalists and from Al Jazeera,
and did
but
those
later did, even from the US.
Did those journalists ask to connect with the local people on the ground?
To some extent, they did. In fact, some journalists were asking us for contact numbers, and we discussed it with the Bahraini, our Bahraini hosts, and we decided that we were not going to give those contacts out, that they would have to, you know, because basically someone who knows the scene, who has been doing the work, should know how to reach the Bahraini activists, including, you know, because they're very public and they're very present on the internet. So, you know, the Twitter, I mean, I developed such an enormous respect for Twitter, which I never really had, because I really saw how it functions as like a, as almost a virtual live stream, you know, that you can get up to the minute news. I mean, we just learned yesterday that two more of our people had been arrested by seeing a tweet from a lawyer in Bahrain. So, you know, so we knew that you can find anyone who's doing their homework and who is serious about wanting to cover it knows how to contact the Bahraini human rights activists. And we felt that for us to give out contact numbers could be extremely dangerous because our phones were being monitored. And we had put our phone numbers out on press releases, and that meant we understood from Bahraini activists that probably the government was actively listening to our phone calls. We're pretty sure that some of us at least were arrested by being tracked through our through the GPS in our phones.
Well, Kate, thank you. Thank you for calling in with that report. That's Kate Raphael. She and 10 human rights activists were arrested on the ground in Bahrain this week. Kate works with Women's Magazine on KPFA. And Mona, what are your thoughts on this? It's interesting to hear Kate talk about what transpired before and after they arrived with in terms of media coverage.
Well, the thing is, throughout the year of the revolution in Bahrain, there have been many attempts of journalists to go there and document. I think the most notably when Nick Christophe was denied visa constantly, and then when he went, they tried all the ways to fight him and tell him that you are not welcomed, so you should leave. But it added a lot of value when someone with his name and his fame and the New York Times gave some space for Bahrain, and that, you know, I think that was very, very helpful for the cause. However, the recent, you know, American activists going and visiting Bahrain, I think it's if it's not the only one, maybe it's one of the few attempts of activists to go there and try to report on what's happening, the violations, and you know, from the ground, so they would give it like some sense of reality. And another thing is that, you know, the way she said that U.S. media or Western media in general tried to contact them, that shows you how Western media tries to always, you know, catch the foreigner over there and take their perspective, because they have this belief, let's say, that if they contact a local, it might not be as reliable, because those people have prejudice. They are either with the regime or against the regime. So they won't have the input of a foreigner. So, and I don't necessarily agree with this. I think it's beneficial that, you know, we have a third person on the ground, but sometimes it's very important to listen to the locals.
Mona, hold that thought. Just if you could stay with us for a couple more minutes, we're going to break, and I'd like to ask Greg and Michael after the break if they have a question for you. Today it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're discussing coverage of what's happening on the ground in Bahrain and how difficult it is for journalists to actually report from that country. And we will continue this, and then later in the show we'll talk about coverage of President Obama's budget and the payroll tax holiday. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
If you're on Facebook, becoming a fan of KLW is an easy way to spread the word about the programming that you value right here on local public radio. It's pretty easy. You just click the Facebook link on the front page of KLW.org. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter there to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about how the U.S. Conference of Bishops became so powerful. Why are these, well, all men dominating the birth control debate? What is their history, membership, funding, and political connections? How did they get so much power in Washington? That's on Monday. And then Tuesday, we'll talk about why there are so few regulations on imported food and why does the U.S. import so much food? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're joined by independent journalist Mona Karine, who's reporting about what's happening on the ground in Bahrain from outside of the country for Global Voices, Jadalia.com, and MigrantRights.com. We're also joined by Greg Kaufman, writer for The Nation, where he has a blog called This Week in Poverty. And Michael McAuliffe is a senior congressional correspondent for The Huffington Post. And Mona, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask Greg and Michael if they have any questions for you. Greg, do you have any questions for Mona?
I do. Mona, I'm interested in what you're hearing about U.S. government involvement or lack of U.S. government involvement from people in Bahrain.
Thank you. And I wanted to add to that that Al Jazeera English reports that Bahrain has hired a number of public relations firms that are working on the $53 million weapons contract with the United States that's been delayed. Can you talk about that, Mona, the U.S. relationship with Bahrain?
Number one, we have. I need to point out that the majority of HR companies hired by the Bahrain regime are actually U.S.-based. These HR regimes, companies are attacking activists online, attacking anyone who carries information online. They are, let's say, an electronic army that try to confuse foreigners and tell them, oh, this is not happening, and that those who are protesting are just traitors, you know. They're not asking for anyone, and they are violent. All of these, you know, they're trying to create a false image. So it's a huge battle, and the 12 HR companies are already listed, and they are online, but no one is doing anything about it. This is a big scandal, and unfortunately, there hasn't been any coverage from media in this regard. Another thing to say is that, of course, there are so many calls from the Bahraini people to U.S. Policy, U.S. Decision makers. They are saying, you know, like, most of the tear gas, most of the, like, weapons are coming from the U.S. There's a U.S. base, army base in Bahrain. The U.S., they believe the U.S. realizes completely what's going on the ground. And already, you know, the White House tried to make statements calling the Bahraini regime to, you know, stop dialogue or make reforms and so on. But the people believe that this is not serious, that the U.S. can make more pressure and can, you know, give more focus for what's going on. So the regime will be pushed into stopping the violence and creating change. That's the perspective between Bahrainis and media. And just one last point, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to say that what's dangerous about the Bahraini case is that, especially in the Arab world, it's not just the lack of media as much as it is false reporting. So you see all these news all over the Arab world because they are controlled by, you know, their regimes and their dictatorships. They are trying to say, no, this is not a real revolution, this is a conspiracy, this is, you know, this is something out of sectarianism. So in this way, the people are feeling, you know, more enraged that, you know, their revolution is not being respected and no one is listening to them because people have been brainwashed or misled by mainstream media.
Oh, that's a good point. And we'll put the link to the Al Jazeera piece that does look at the public relation firms in the U.S. that have been hired by the government on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Michael, do you have a question for Mona?
I'm curious if she thinks there's any way or any simple way for U.S. media to improve the coverage.
I believe the U.S. media knows its way around. The U.S. media is very, let's say, experienced when it comes to social media, and they have so many contacts. The Bahraini activists are always, you know, welcoming you know, being protected from media because they're trying to expose what's going on. So they know the ways around. The problem is with the general policies of these publications or TV stations or whatever. Number one, their focus is going on with, you know, Syria because of the debate over intervention. And number two, because of the sensitivity and the U.S. stand towards Bahrain and the revolution. And number three is that you have some publications that I would call they are right-wing or slash moderate right-wing who are not making pressure, and instead they're trying to say, oh, there are attempts of reforms, but we need to give it more time. And that's you know, that's an illusion. It's not about time, it's about the intentions of the regime.
We have a comment on our website from Zach who says, is it not a greater crime to suppress the will of the people than to have them die for the cause they believe in? America's military interest supporting Bahrain while the government condemns the Syrian leader is hypocrisy. Turning our backs on a revolution being gunned down is criminal. And we have a question from Eid. And Eid, stay on the line. You can ask about your question about China in a minute, but we have to let Mona go. So I'm going to ask your question about Saudi Arabia. And he wanted to know, what is the role of Saudi Arabia in protecting the Bahraini government?
Oh, of course. I mean, Saudi Arabia was the main player of oppressing the people. They are the ones who led, you know, the campaign to get the Shield of Peninsula inside Bahrain. They took part of oppressing the people when this is not legitimate and this is none of their business, and there is no such thing that legalized, of course, what's going on. I mean, it's a big play, and it's very inhumane, very disrespectful for the people, and everyone watched in silence. So they were really enraged. So military, they tried to oppress them. Another thing is that, and if there is any intention inside the ruling family or the royal family in Bahrain to do some change to calm the people off, Saudi Arabia fights this because Saudi Arabia feels very intimidated of having change in neighboring countries. They believe if any change happens in the region, that will mean change inside Saudi Arabia. And that's why they're trying to fight it this way or another. And this is not only with Bahrain. It's very obvious in Bahrain, but it also can be applied with the case of Kuwait, for example. They try to play secretly or like indirectly against change. It's just change intimidates such a country.
Well, Mona, thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love to have you back in a couple of weeks. We'll definitely be following this.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Mona Karine is an independent journalist who writes for Global Voices, Jadalia.com, and MigrantRights.com. She has been covering what's happening on the ground in Bahrain, but because journalists cannot get inside the country, she's been relying on her contacts there as along with social media. And we're going to switch gears now and talk with Greg Kaufman, writer with The Nation, and Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent for The Huffington Post, about coverage of President Obama's budget and the payroll tax holiday deal that was just struck recently and passed this morning. And if you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of these issues, based on the reporting you've read and heard, do you know what's actually in these deals, or is this mainly about politics? We actually got an email a couple days ago from someone who said, please focus on the details and not so much the politics, because that's what we usually get in media coverage. So what are your thoughts on that? And if there was a story you saw this week that you think deserves attention or criticism, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So why don't we dive in, Michael, and talk about this payroll tax holiday deal that was just struck and these votes that just came down today. This has been changing drastically over the past couple days. So give us the latest.
Well, the latest is that it passed, and it passed very easily with perfect bipartisan support, which is, you know, very rare. And they managed to do that because, first, I think because they have a vacation next week and they wanted to get out of town. But more to the point, it was a very damaging political fight for the Republicans, and they needed to get it off the table. So they essentially gave in to Democrats and decided that the payroll tax cut, which is 2%, worth about $100 billion, would not be paid for. It would be just added to the deficit, which made it much easier for Democrats to get on board. They didn't have as much incentive to fight about it. And they could no longer make that argument that Republicans were trying to protect their rich friends at the expense of people in the middle class. So that really ease the way, but there are still some sort of poison pills in there, if you will. The big ones being that it does start shrinking unemployment insurance, emergency unemployment insurance, fairly dramatically by the end of the year. It should be down from about 99 weeks now to 73 weeks. And that may actually be okay if the economy improves more, but at the same time, there'll be a lot of people who run out of benefits completely. Then there's some restrictions in there, like they threw in a drug testing requirement for people who are on unemployment. It doesn't cover everybody there. It covers people in certain jobs, and there's a dispute about how many that would affect. Republicans say it will affect many, which is probably something they need to say to their base. Democrats say it'll affect very few people, and we'll probably have to wait until the Department of Labor comes out with how it would be implemented.
And Michael, on that point, yeah, on the drug testing, did many Democrats stand up against this?
Well, they did in the earlier versions of the bill, because it would have been much more punitive, much more of a complete dragnet for anybody on unemployment. So it was one of the real sticking points in the final negotiations. And they ultimately settled on this compromise where if you had been, you lost your job because of a failed drug test, or if you're in some sort of sensitive job, then maybe you have to get drug tested. So that's where you get the dispute over how many people would be involved. So Democrats think it essentially does very little, and Republicans say it does quite a lot.
And what about the requirement to ask new federal employees to contribute an additional 2.3% into their benefit plan?
Well, that nearly killed the thing.
Right.
And not necessarily for purely to help, because Democrats wanted to help federal workers, but there was this strange squabble in the Senate where their three members on this conference committee that worked it all out were refusing to sign the report, which is fine because there were four Democrats, no problem, you get it through, you get it passed. But then Ben Cardin, a Democratic senator from Maryland with a lot of federal employees in his state, got a look at the fine print. And he wasn't about to sign that for his state. So they had to go and fight. And it winds up where new employees of the federal government, this is the compromise, will have to pay about 3% into their own pension plan. This is not a 401k. This is the old-fashioned federal pension. They're going to have to pick up 3% of that cost, which saves $13 billion. To pay for the unemployment insurance. So there were a lot of Democrats who were really upset about that day, especially from Maryland and Virginia, where you have so many employees.
And Greg, you recently wrote about another provision that would have reduced the number of low-income families eligible for the child tax credit. I mean, we're talking about families who earn $21,000 a year, and under this plan, they would have lost $1,800 a year in income?
That's right. That on average, that's true. And before I go into that, I just wanted to compliment you, Michael, on one of your, I mean, you've written so much about the payroll tax negotiations, but a recent piece you wrote going towards that issue of making sure we talk to the people who this impacts, you interviewed a guy named Steve Bachman and had some really good insights about what would happen to him if this deal hadn't gone through. And I thought it really humanized the issue well.
Well, thanks. I have to give Arthur Delaney credit for that one. He is our designated unemployment reporter, and he gets human stories about that every day, so he gets full credit for that.
Okay, good. Well, it was a good one. But yeah, Rose, this child tax credit, and I don't know. I'd be interested to hearing from Michael how, in the end, it was pulled out. I mean, the Republicans were pushing hard to require that only people who had a Social Security number would be eligible for the child tax credit. So what that means is people who file taxes using, I think it's called like an individual tax return number, which happens to be a number of undocumented workers, even if their kids are born here in the country, they would no longer be eligible for the child tax credit. And on average, these are people making $21,000 a year. And on average, that tax credit is refund is $1,800. So it would be a real hit for people already struggling in low-wage work and often living in poverty.
And how many families in this country earn less than 21 grand a year?
That's a great question.
I don't know what the exact number is, but it's that's somewhere around where the bottom fifth quintile of the economic ladder is.
Right. I mean, we have...
For families I'm talking about there.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, we have 46 million people living in poverty. Poverty for a family of four is about $22,350.
Okay, so you've got, 46 million people making right around that amount of money.
Right, right.
How did this get pulled out, Michael? Do you know?
Well, you know, I don't know how it got pulled out, but I can guess pretty well. There's a lot of discontent within the Hispanic caucus and within the Progressive caucus at the way immigration has been treated for the last 3 years, even under President Obama. They seem to be the group that always gets the short end of the stick in whatever the negotiations are, and they've been getting angrier and angrier, and I suspect that they said they would be extremely angry if this went through. I mean, and also one of their bigger spokesmen, Javier Becerra from California, was a member of the conference committee, so I would suspect that he made it a particular issue.
And Rose, I just wanted to add,
sure.
I mean, this, I think it was pretty close. I mean, I talked to people who were close to negotiations, staffers, and a number of them really thought the Democrats were going to cave. So, you know, it's closer than we'd like to think. And the other thing that was interesting to me was I'd speak with advocates, some of whom didn't know how hard and how publicly to push on this, because they felt like Democrats, if forced to choose publicly, would be uncomfortable saying, I want to give this child tax credit to people who are undocumented workers. So there wasn't even an agreement within the community about whether to make that fight. But I have to say most advocates did fight and fight very hard.
All right. So tell us a little bit more. What else do we need to know about this before we move on? How does this affect average people, especially people who are really struggling right now? Because I find that so much of the reporting is focused on the politics and not really the details.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for if you're an average person, it means you get to keep a little extra money in your paycheck every week, you know, which goes a long way.
About how much?
That's really the bottom line, and that's why it passed.
About how much?
It's if you're a family earning about $50,000 saves about $1,000 for the whole year.
For the whole year. All right. Well, we've got a caller on this. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you for taking my call. My question is on this payroll tax deduction. It seems to me if it's carried out for any length of time, it'll undermine the Social Security basis or the actuarial basis for the Social Security system. And it's possible that because of this undermining of the system by these payroll tax cuts, that if President Obama is reelected in 2012, that sometime in his term, there'll be a new commission formed to deal with Social Security. And sure enough, they'll come up with some sort of a plan for making it voluntary or making it an investment plan or doing something else that'll change the system from the way it has been since Franklin Roosevelt signed the legislation back in 1935.
Well, we've got an email on that from Denise who says some are characterizing the payroll tax cut as a payday loan because this cut depletes the Social Security fund. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, there's two answers to that. The first is the official Democratic Party line, which is that the money that would have gone into the Social Security Trust Fund is being replaced completely from the General Treasury reserves, so that it doesn't take anything ultimately out of the Social Security Trust Fund. However, I did a story this morning off of a speech that Tom Harkin, senator from Iowa, made, where he points out that until this bill, you could never argue that Social Security adds to the deficit. With this bill, you set a precedent where you do take general tax revenues and use it to pay for Social Security. Mm. So that argument is now gone, and it sort of strengthens the other side when they say, okay, it's time to start making changes to Social Security and either to save it or to keep it solvent or to lower the deficit. So what the caller was talking about there is a fear of some of the more progressive and liberal Democrats.
And Harkin really took the president to task, didn't he, Michael?
Oh, yeah. He said it was an embarrassment. He, as a Democrat, he believes that Social Security and a strong Social Security is sort of a fundamental tenet of the party, you know, started by a Democrat, strengthened by Democrats like Kennedy. And he said, I can't believe that I'm alive to see the day when a Democratic president and a Democratic vice president are undermining Social Security. Unraveling was the word he used.
Mm. We'll have to do a show on this. Thank you for the call. We have just about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I wanted to spend some time talking about President Obama's budget. I also wanted to mention that he was in town last night in San Francisco. 3 sold-out fundraisers. He went to a private dinner where the tickets cost $38,500 a pop. And then he was at the Masonic last night where Soundgarden's Chris Cornell played for the low price of $7,500. You could get a photo. This was on the front page of the Chronicle, although it doesn't mention how much he raised, so we'll have to find that. But you can bet that it was a lot of money. So let's talk about President Obama's budget. And the headline for your piece, Michael, is President Obama's budget would tax the rich and cut Medicare. What are the details in this that we need to know about?
Well, the details are, at least for the headline there, is that he wants to raise revenue by about $1.5 trillion over the span of the budget, which is 10 years. And it would do that in part by ending the Bush-era tax cuts, by closing, you know, various loopholes. And don't ask me what they all are, because I really don't remember.
That's fine. Would it completely end all of the Bush tax cuts?
Yeah, that's the proposal in the budget.
Okay.
Now, nobody believes that will actually happen.
Right.
But that's what's in the budget. And then when you start talking about the cuts, there's around $300 billion or so to Medicare, and supposedly that mostly comes from providers so that it wouldn't hurt beneficiaries too much. But there are things in there that raises the cost of co-pays, and I believe there's some means testing in that as well. So there is a burden on recipients of Medicare. And then there are another $278 billion in various other health care savings and a huge chunk from the military as well.
What do you mean by huge?
I believe it was around $478 billion. I could be a little off on that.
And is that over 10 years?
Yes.
Okay. And, Greg, you really focused on how the budget would affect the working poor and low-income families.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I just wanted to add to the unemployment issue real quick. Last year, unemployment insurance system kept 4.6 million people above poverty. So that 46 million number would have been 50 million. Mm. So these extensions mean a big deal to people. But in terms of the budget, there are a few items that I'm hearing a lot about that are disappointing from a poverty perspective. One is almost a 50% cut to the community services block grant. Now that goes towards over 1,000 community action agencies that are really the focus of a lot of anti-poverty work. So we're going to hear a lot of people concerned about that. The other big cut I'm hearing about is to the low-income home energy assistance program, $452 million out of that. And these are people, you know, the president likes to talk about shared sacrifice, but these are people who don't have anything left to share. I mean, you really can't, when you can't pay for your heat or your cooling in the summer,
I wanted to give kudos to the New York Times. Earlier this month, they had an incredible story called In Fuel Oil Country, Cold That Cuts to the Heart. And it was about people in Western Maine who are going from their cars to under their covers because they're so cold. I mean, they're starting their cars because they have no heat.
Yeah.
In some cases, they're selling their cars to pay for heat.
Right. Yeah, and we're going to hear a lot more of these kinds of stories because there's going to be a big push to try to get that funding up to $5.1 billion instead of, I think, Obama's calling for $3.1 billion. I might be wrong. I don't know if, Michael, you have the exact figures on that.
No, I think that's about right. I don't remember what the exact number is, but around $3 billion was what's in my head.
And what is the justification for cutting the low-income home energy assistance program?
You got me. I mean, I think politically he's assuming that Democrats will push to raise that funding. I think he's trying to show that he can make what he would call hard choices. It's disappointing to me, but I think it's a political ploy.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the only way to really look at that document and understand it is as a political election year document. And if you had any doubt about that, the leaders of the Senate, Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer, have already said that they will not have a vote on that budget. That's never, ever going to be enacted into law. So it's his way of saying, I'm still going to try and take care of, you know, as many of these constituent groups as I can, but here I am, message to the independents, I'm being very responsible, and I am making hard choices. So, Matt, right. I think that's really the point of that budget. And when you start talking about the cuts that are proposed in there, they may or may not ever happen, but the problem with them, especially if you're looking at it from the poverty perspective, is Republicans will then say, look, even the president says we should cut this program.
Right.
That's right. It's
so
very important. Go ahead.
Things like that. Then that debate pops in there.
Mm.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we really need to do a show about this. I thank you both for your reporting, for actually going beyond the spin and the politics and focusing on the specifics of these plans. Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent with the Huffington Post, and Greg Kaufman, writer for The Nation, where he blogs. He has a blog called This Week in Poverty, one of the few journalists who specifically focuses on poverty in this country. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How did the U.S. Conference of Bishops become so powerful? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Catholic bishops' history, membership, funding, and political connections. They're currently fighting a federal mandate that would have required all health insurance plans to provide free birth control. Why are the Catholic bishops dominating the birth control debate? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Why does the U.S. Conference of Bishops have so much power in Washington? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.